So is there anything that comes to your mind from that early period that you would like me to talk about?
Think at the moment, I don't have a special idea. I think we should go on in the line of events where we were finishing yesterday. If you don't want to speak about
No,
something.
I just, other things will come up, but
Yeah.
I told you that one thing is what the orbital symmetry story meant to the world of chemistry, and that itself is interesting. Actually, it didn't talk about that. It has many dimensions, but it was a nexus, a meeting point of two subfields of chemistry, theoretical chemistry and organic chemistry. These nexuses, maybe there's a Latin plural, are important in science, and they're interesting. And I can point to a few others. But this particular one was prepared for, not in the context of a direct forerunner, though Jeff Siemon is investigating many people. It was in the air. It could have been done by any of a number of people, not me. There was a special confluence in my case, but what I'm talking about is the other precedent for a meeting ground of organic and theoretical chemistry was the rediscovery and fleshing out of Hickel's rules in period 1950 to 1960 by people like Dehring, Breslau and Katz, and we mentioned people making cyclopropenium cation, cyclooctatetraene cation, other 2 and 10 electron Hickel systems with 6 electron. That, I think, in general, European chemistry was behind. I think German chemistry had not yet recovered from World War II, though there was a new generation of physical organic chemists rising. I mentioned Krege and Vogel, who were two, and Hüsgen, who were of that generation. But in America, that took root, and that was very exciting period of making aromatic molecules. That was the precedent, and ours, I think, the orbital symmetry work made that very real. After that, there was no way that a organic chemist would not have an introduction to quantum mechanics. That was part of the education, part of the general psyche. It was demonstrated that it was important. And that was interesting. There were other reasons why the orbital symmetry work was so successful in its way. Another is that there was a community of physical organic chemists who was ready to do the experiments to test the predictions. So this now has to do with communities of chemists. In some ways, the preparation for this was non-classical carbonium ions, not overall terribly productive, but a discussion in physical organic chemistry that produced students who were able to study these problems. If you make a prediction that takes 50 years to test, it'll not generate a dynamic in the field. But if the predictions are testable within a year, then it generates a real dynamic. People test it, publish, other people, they notice it, and so on. So I think that's what part of what went on around the orbital symmetry story in the period 1965 to 70. The third thing I would say more generally about what I did in what that story did and what other work that I did on reactive intermediates, their electronic structure, after I came to Cornell, in the period, the 10 years before I turned to inorganic problems, what the period 65 to 75, what that did is it created a language for organic chemistry. That language was a mixture of small three-dimensional representations of structure. So after 1960 or so, with Barton's work and conformational analysis in organic chemistry, no organic chemist ever drew cyclohexane as a plain six-membered ring. They drew it in a chair form. And they drew nobody typeset norbornane as CH2, CH2, CH, CH2. They did a three-dimensional drawing. So part of what's going on here is what's allowed typographically by the journals, but part of it is what was necessitated. And what we did was add to an existing stereochemical graphic representation of organic chemistry a little similarly graphic and easy to grasp language showing what electrons were doing in molecules. So people drawing lone pairs, they drew for the first time the phases of orbitals. That's what became apparent from our work. So that people added on, it was on the same level. As long as it remained in numbers, where I was in 1964, where I told you about, in sheafs of numbers, there was no way of grafting that information visually into a form that chemists would communicate to each other on paper and with paper and pencil, the tools of their time, on a restaurant white paper cover. They couldn't communicate that, or in papers, if you had to refer to numbers in a calculation. But by adding these little orbital pictures, they were commensurate with the graphic tools already available to organic chemists, and they were not that hard to learn. So it became tremendously successful, and it's nothing, I've written a little bit about it, very little, but I think this is part of what makes that story so successful. In some way, there are many interesting things here related to paper tools and Ursula Klein's ideas and about these things, and there are many interesting things here for history of and sociology of science and the interaction of scientific communities. We were lucky. What I said last time, and I want to reemphasize, is one thing is what orbital symmetry meant to the world. The orbital symmetry, the complex of ideas. The other thing is what it did to me, and I've told you that. It transformed me from a calculator to an explainer.
There are a couple of questions that I would like to ask as a follow-up here with that story. The example you mentioned, the non-classical carbonium ion, I mean, there is a sort of controversy attached to it, at least in discussion, brown versus the rest, in a way, as I understand it. Was there a similar thing with orbital symmetry?
No.
Why not?
It was immediately accepted. There was a controversy about could it have been done in other ways? Yes. It could have all been done with Dewar's papers from 1952, which were incomprehensible to the community. So there were people who did it other ways, and very quickly they came up very good competitive way to look at it in terms of aromaticity of transition states. So there were claims on where there are precursors, but there was no controversy on the validity of the conclusions. It's only now that it is surfacing some controversy, which we could talk about. The reason was that the theory, this way of thinking, made portable, verifiable, sometimes risky predictions, which could be and were tested within a year or two, and the tests were convincing. It's the portable. What I mean by that is, I've written something about why buy that theory, an article in American Scientist. Why do people accept theories? And I think, in addition to the usual things, there are aesthetic elements, there is storytelling aspects of theories, there is portable and productive is, I think, important. Productive just means that theories suggest experiments. Theories which don't suggest experiments will languish and eventually fade away. Because science is about the interaction of theory and experiment. Portable just means that other people than the person who devised the theory can use it easily. And that's what orbital symmetry was. I remember the day that Jerry Burson called and told us that a 1-3 sigma tropic shift, a very specific reaction, he designed a test of it, that it went with inversion of configuration. That was a risky prediction because a least motion, that atoms move least during a reaction, would have predicted the opposite result. But the atoms follow what the electrons tell them to do. So that was our contribution. The point was that Burson didn't have to ask us, was this going to come out? He could apply the ideas we had. And that kind of power put in the hands of course, clever experimentalists had tremendous impact.
You mentioned already some names, but could you describe us the community of these early adopters and what their main achievements and their various roles were in that?
Well, Jerry Burson was an early supporter. He was a professor at Yale at the time and a leading physical organic chemist, a student of Bill Durring. Bill Durring was perhaps conflicted in his attitudes, feelings. There's some complex relationship between Durring and Woodward, which goes back to their early work together in World War II. But Durring also saw the power of this explanation. Other important actors were the three German physical organic chemists I mentioned, of Rudolf Krieger, of Emanuel Vogel and Rolf Hüsgen, also a younger chemist, Wolfgang Roth, who was in Bochum eventually, played an important role in this. In the United States, there was a scattering of sort of early adapters of the theory, some of them people not so well known, but there was a pretty wide community.
How did the communication channels work?
They worked through the literature on meetings.
No letters, no correspondence?
Yes, there was letters and correspondence.
I'm surprised by the German impact.
Yeah?
Because what I remember is that the, what you were also just describing, that after World War II, the Germans were behind the Americans,
especially with
regard to physical organic chemistry, which was, we could argue, then a U.S. specialty, right?
That's right. Germany was coming out of a period of pre-war dominance of synthetic chemistry, synthetic organic chemistry. There were a few spots of, and a failure to recognize Haeckel's ideas, another whole story by itself. There is a story also, there was some other interesting work on spectroscopy by Kuhn, and also some by Klar, but Kuhn's work was very important, but it was not received by the organic chemists. Yes, it was coming up very fast. Some of these people were trained before World War II. Another one was a German-trained chemist who was in Romania, Costin Nanitescu, who also played a part in this. Germany was coming up in physical organic chemistry. And it was recognized. There's a prescient comment involving orbitals in a recorded comment by Woodward in a 1961 proceedings of a Welch symposium on chemistry. There was a series of such symposia. The talk was by Rolf Hüsgen about 1,3 dipolar reactions. And Hüsgen and Woodward makes a comment with a sketch of orbitals on that. It's in the proceedings. Interesting. Woodward was a Germanophile also in his own way. He liked also England a lot and other things, but he paid a lot of attention to German chemistry.
Okay.
And cultivated his connections there.
What was the role of Woodward? I mean, he was world famous at that time.
He was the leader of world chemistry, I think. Somehow taking over from Robinson and Ingold in England.
What does leading world chemistry mean?
The work that he did was I think it set the style. It was paradigmatic in setting the style of synthetic organic chemistry, and in a process using, and at the same time he had this lifelong interest in the Diels-Alder reaction and its mechanism, which goes back to a story he tells in his Cope lecture, which is detailed in the CHF book, of his writing at age 11. So Woodward was one of the rare, very rare instances of precocity in chemistry. We don't have it much, which I take as a sign, a good sign, incidentally. That precocity to me is I'm afraid of it, even though as I love it, recognize it. It's a sign that there is a talent for something. Math and music have precocity in them. And that there be a talent, meaning a natural predisposition to do something well, that to me looks in some way as a barrier to my doing well.
Why?
Because I'm not talented.
Oh.
That is, you have to be born with that talent. You have to be Mozart. Okay, his father pushes him ahead. But you have to be like Mozart. And I think chemistry and poetry and politics, though in each of those children whom we romanticize and who are the repository of our dreams, in a way, there are children who are good in their own way in politics. My children, when they wanted an ice cream cone, if they asked for it in English and they didn't get it, they would ask for it in Swedish. That's a primitive exercise of political intuition. But chemistry in general, there are no children who are great chemists. It takes a balance of judgment and moving in between a logical, intuitive world and a less logical one in chemistry that I think makes chemistry, it takes maturity to do chemistry.
How was it like to work with a natural-born genius chemist?
Yeah, it was wonderful. He had also mannerisms which enhanced the feeling of genius. I mean, he did various structure. He created structures around himself, whether it was wearing the color blue or going to the library and reading the journals in the middle of a night. He limited access to himself, but when you saw him, you had the feeling that all the thought powers of the world converged on you and him at the same time. It was a quality of giving you undivided attention and a feeling that he was thinking. He liked the Nero Wolf detective stories, and those were... And that detective had that power, which I saw a parallel between Nero Wolfe, or my constructed image. Who wrote those books? It was a couple. They were popular, but it was the power of a super rational detective. He knew the literature vastly. He knew everything. So part of the... But there were some things I caught up in some part, and I think another interesting story is how does a pair of helping hands, which is what I described, happened in the beginning of the interaction, which was true for the first paper. That is, he had the explanation, the simple orbital explanation. He wasn't sure of himself, I think. That was not a characteristic one associated with Woodward, not being sure of oneself. You get that from the book. But I think he wasn't, and he looked for support from calculations, from what were, at that moment in time, probably the best calculations that one could muster. My luck in this was that I had these calculations. They didn't remain the best calculations for more than a year, but I had the calculations. And so, in the beginning, and you can tell that from the drafts, which Jeff Seaman is going to show, of the first paper, that I'm just providing numbers to support Woodward's explanation. How does a pair of helping hands transform into a true collaboration? So the second paper has my name first, which is pretty unusual for Woodward and those things. But it was his doing. I wasn't deciding whose name was going to be first. So there was, but part of the transformation, this is an interesting subject for a PhD thesis. How does mentor-apprentice turn into collaboration? This was one study, one such case. I think one of the things that happens is when the young person tells the older person something that the older person didn't know, and when the older person has the charity and the spirit to recognize that he didn't know that. And there were such moments around the cyclopropane reaction. where I think I sort of told Woodward something he didn't know. And then we were in a collaboration somehow.
Whom did you tell first after Woodward about what you were doing in this crucial first year?
In the very beginning, the first month or two, I actually told Corey, because Corey gave me somehow the feeling that he was involved in the story. And eventually that bothered me enough that some months later when we wrote the paper, I asked Woodward if Corey had an interest, and Woodward said no. There was no eureka moment, there was nothing like that. It was a slow evolution over months. And then things went more quickly in 65. But my wife I didn't know this stuff was important. The evidence for that is in the notebooks, as I told you. My wife didn't know it was important. I've talked to her. I talked to other people, to Lionel Salem, who was a friend. He was an instructor at Harvard at the time. I talked to Lipscomb and Goodman both, but they were not interested in organic chemistry. The stereochemistry of organic reactions, somehow they weren't interested. It's not that I'm just reporting a reaction, but I talked about it to a few people. The major interest I got was at early on at two national meetings, and not one, organic symposium in June 64, where I just mentioned the beginning of the story, and then in October 64, there was the U.S. Army Research Office ran an annual symposium at a Natick Air Force Base, I think, or some base in Massachusetts, and I forget who it was who gave the talk. It was Krieger, I think, and I gave a comment. He talked about the reactions. I explained them afterwards, and I may be wrong about Krieger, and several people in the audience, Jeff has hunted them down, remember my comments as an explanation of this unusual stereochemistry. But I think Krieger, if that was him, was puzzled. He was an older chemist. He wasn't schooled in orbital ways. Jeff will trace the story of Woodward's interest in molecular orbital theory, which in the beginning he writes his papers all in terms of valence bond theory, resonance structures, about, and molecular orbital theory comes late, I'm convinced, through the influence of Bill Moffat, the same person that I went to work with, who died, who was a friend of Woodward's, and they together published a paper. Moffat published a paper, I think, by himself. They were involved in two stories together, the ferrocene story of the structure and the octant rule, theoretical. Moffat provided a theoretical explanation of the empirical deduction of the octant rule. And that is, I think, when Woodward began to think in orbital ideas. This is now around the period of 55 to 58. There is much more to say, and we'll hear more from Jeff Seaman about this story.
One thing that I'm curious about, partly because I know what happens in 1981, was there any connection to the science that was happening? You've mentioned connections in Europe, but was there any knowledge of what was happening in Japan? Was that a community that really,
mm-hmm.
there was no common language at the
so
time?
So the Japanese community was rising rapidly too.
Mm-hmm.
Not experimentally in physical organic, there was no tradition there. But the theoretical community was good. I knew of Fukui's work, and there were at that time, coming out of Hickel theory, out of molecular orbital calculations, people get stuck until we did the extended Hickel theory. People were stuck on pi systems, on planar molecules with pi systems. For these, they were also getting out from the Hickel calculations, reactivity indices. A good indicator of the knowledge of the time is Andy Streitwieser's book, influential book of 1960 on molecular orbital theory, which that and Jack Roberts' much shorter teaching primer were the introduction for organic chemists of molecular orbital theory. There were other important books in Russia and in France, but they did not reach the consciousness of the organic chemists. And Coulson's Valence, tremendously important book, did not have enough about organic chemistry. There was a lot of discussion about reactivity indices from Hickel calculations, things which would tell you where nucleophilic or electrophilic, where acid and base reactions would go on organic pi systems. Hickel devised his frontier orbital ideas in the context of a reactivity index, and he talked. And because his background was also, I think, from polymer chemistry, or part of it, he was one of the few who talked about radical reactions. He devised these frontier orbital ideas, and they were, as reactivity indices, they were known to the community of theoretical chemists. Even theoretical chemists, and especially theoretical chemists working on organic molecules. I meet Fukui first time in 1964. Yes. There is a Sanibel conference run by Lev Dean, and Fukui comes to it. And we meet, he comes to visit Harvard. I think I was his host at that time. We talk, but nothing about these reactions. Our work was developed independently, but it could have been done with his methodology. He could have done it. He didn't, till after. But so it could have been done. Jeff has a catalog of maybe about 15 people who could have done it, what we did.
You were describing the reaction by physical organic chemists. But there, of course, is also the other important community for you, which is the theoretical chemists.
Yes.
What was their reaction?
In the beginning, so, for the first half year or so, there was no reaction. This was an interesting application. There was no reaction, which is why I didn't get those jobs that I told you about. Then what happens is Christopher Longett Higgins and Abrahamson, who was a very good physical chemist, postdoc of Longett Higgins, submit in December a more symmetry-based explanation of the stereochemistry of electrocyclic reactions and draw the first published correlation diagrams which show how levels behave in the course of reaction. We get that paper as a preprint, we get it to review, we approve it, that paper gave me the idea of using the correlation diagrams, which I had drawn previously for some reactions, but didn't realize how important they were. They gave me a way to analyze what I thought simpler cycloadditions, so we used them in our second paper. But somehow Longit-Higgins, using this very formal symmetry-based approach, legitimizes in the eyes of the theoretical community, of which he was a prime member, our work. And
did he know about your first paper?
Yes.
Okay.
First of all, he knew about the problem because Woodward posed it as a problem to him.
Okay.
Did he know of our first paper when he published his? No, because he sent us. But he knew, yes, he didn't know at the time he did. You know, I don't know the sequence. I think our first paper was, I know for sure our first paper was not published before he wrote, we saw his preprint. What I don't know is if Woodward had sent him a preprint of our paper. I think he might have, but I'm not sure of that. Let's call it for the moment independent work. Those symmetry considerations for our third important paper on sigmatropic reactions, we didn't use those. We used symmetry, but we didn't use correlation diagrams. Those correlation diagrams were imprisoning in a way, even as they were very useful. But by connecting to the correlation diagrams connected me again to the theoretical community. The theoretical community, though, was moving beyond the extended Hückel calculations that I came out from the Lipscomb work that I used on the orbital symmetry story in the beginning and that I continued to use from then on for 30 years to do a lot of good chemistry. Those semi-empirical calculations, which were at the forefront of theoretical chemistry in 1964, within two or three years, were surpassed. They were viewed as too simple. They were surpassed by the so-called ab initio calculations. And so, as a joke later on, I would say, we do the kind of calculations, extended Hückel calculations, to which all other methods are superior. And you can be sure that the authors of those methods tell us so. What I'm reflecting bitterly, slightly, it was typical referees' comments that we got. They would say, can't be right because you've done it with. And of course, what kept us going is first of all, the methods weren't so bad. They captured the essence of the process. Second, I knew the chemistry, which the other theoreticians didn't. So what they didn't realize is what they were saying is that this is not a matter of solving the equations exactly. It's a matter of getting an approximate theory and it making chemical sense. And that somehow I stayed ahead because I knew the chemistry.
So what you are saying, if I understand right, is that this was application-driven, chemistry-driven, organic chemistry-driven at that time.
Inorganic chemistry very soon.
Very soon also.
75 on.
But it was problem-driven. and not method driven in a way.
Absolutely.
And
I was interested in explaining chemistry.
Yes.
I love chemistry.
But if I understand what you say, I mean, you encountered problems in your own
as a theoretician.
As a theoretician.
Yep.
How did you solve that? Or did
by keeping on doing more chemistry.
Okay.
I mean, it got at one point, even much later on, I lost all my funding. So the bad referee's comments, you can overcome, you can answer. The bad reviewer's comments on a grant proposal, you don't get a chance to answer. At some point later in the 90s, now in early 2000, I lost all my NSF funding on comments which mixed some skepticism about the science we were doing, also with some nasty comments about the outreach, and I was beginning this entertaining science cabaret, and I put that into the outreach section, and some people didn't like it. Anyway, I regained the funding in 2 years, so that's not a problem. But there was a continuing criticism of the methodology, and at the same time an appreciation by the chemical community in each field. But I think many theoreticians did not understand why our work was so successful. And the answer was simply that I was a chemist in some level, and they really didn't. That's also what the Woodward story taught me. Later I went into inorganic chemistry largely on my own, and I learned the field. And now in the last 20, 30 years I'm in solid state chemistry, mostly inorganic, and close to condensed matter physics, materials under high pressure. It's always been the greatest fun to learn the knowledge base, experimental knowledge base in each of these communities. And I really enjoy that to this day. I mean, just yesterday we're doing something on nitroxyl free radicals, back to organic chemistry. The reason for it has a complicated story, but I found a paper where we were looking at how nitroxyls are a class of stable free radicals. Stable meaning kinetically persistent. One of these free radicals, so these are odd unpaired electrons in a molecule. The molecules are simple, a nitrogen bonded to an oxygen and two substituents, methyl groups or bigger on it. Those are stable free radicals. You can buy a bottle of one of them, and you have a bottle of spins that don't dimerize. The usual fate of free radicals. Free radicals are things with an odd number of electrons. So a hydrogen is a free radical, hydrogen atom, a methyl group, CH3, C6H5. They're of course substituents in organic, but as entities they are. If you generate them, you can study them in a matrix at liquid helium temperatures. You can study them flying down a molecular beam. But if you try to isolate them, they dimerize because the reaction H2 hydrogens to give H2, it has no barrier and is exothermic by 100 kilocalories. So they dimerize like a shot. Nitroxyls don't dimerize. We're just looking at why they don't dimerize. I mean, there are people who've been doing it. Anyway, it turns out that there are some strong interaction geometries. If this is N and this is O, there is one like that and one like that, and they come together to about 2.8 angstroms, and then they stop. There is some weak bonding, not a van der Waals contact between them. And I've seen there are some structures that show this, but no one has done, so far as I can find, a molecular orbital analysis of this. But there am I, I'm looking at the literature and it's still found 54 years down the road.
How do you see molecules?
I see them the way they are represented on the page. I think we all are. I think our imagination is geometric rather than algebraic in what's in there. I even think that's true of mathematicians, and that's another interesting thing. Though algebra has by and large won the day in mathematics, but I think the inner representations that are in there are geometrical, though sometimes I think lines of an algebraic proof acquire geometric form in the mind. A friend of mine in philosophy of mathematics has written a little about this, Emily Grossholz at Penn State. She'd be interesting to have at your place to talk about that, because she and I have written two articles about iconic and symbolic representations in chemistry. Chemistry is a curious mixture of the two. It's obvious from the beginning. I mean, you write a formula C2H6, the C and the H are symbolic, and the 2 and the 6 are iconic. Right in there. And part of what I said about adding those orbitals to the geometric stereochemical formulas, we are walking in some land between symbolic and iconic, a semiotic representation. So there's, Emily and I have written a little about that. And I like case studies. We took a paper by Andy Hamilton and took it apart in terms of the semiotic representation thing. That shows an interest in philosophy, which is another thing. See, what was your question about how do I see molecules? So I see them at various levels, and I can move between them. So the initial level, I see a structural formula like I see it on a page, like I sketch it, as a quasi-two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object. I do not think of the atoms vibrating. I couldn't. My mind is not. But yes, if I turn on some switch and say that says, look at it vibrating, I can begin to see it in my mind. But I don't see it in the first instance. I see it just like you see it on a page. This is why this story about paper tools and typographic conventions for representing molecules is so important. So as long as the Berichte der Deutsche Chemischen Gesellschaft insisted that they could not set this, but insisted on setting this, because stupidly they could only set straight lines, even Kekulé. As long as this was set, that was imprinted in the minds of chemists. And therefore, and look at the 70 years between Sachs's representation of the six-membered ring in cyclohexane and Barton's stereochemical analysis. Why did that have to take place? After we thought that Van 't Hoff and Lebel gave us a way to see, he calls it chemistry in space. That's Van 't Hoff's initial title in Dutch and in a French edition of the 1874 book. But no one sees it in space. Oh yes, they do if they have to, but the stereochemical imagination sees this. And fortunately, we're past that day, though now we're past the other way. So what I mean is this. We now have computer drawings of the molecules as they emerge from a crystal structure. And those are not portable. They are not sketchable. by a chemist on a piece of paper. There will come a day when, like in the movie Matrix, all of us have plugs in the back of our head, and those crystal structures will come in via those, or some receptor, some implant, where those crystal structures will be immediately turned into virtual reality. We'll be walking around with gloves, and they'll flash in a stereo image in there. And then the imagination may change, and these two-dimensional media of the that one that served the community, the chalkboard, for 300, 400 years or longer, and this piece of paper here, they will be obsolete.
Just to follow up on this, one question I have then is, what is the value in being able to see molecules? Thinking about it both as the two-dimensional sense, the drawings that you've just done, but also the three-dimensional sense. What value does that add to, or what knowledge does that help us understand in terms of chemistry? And
so, this is, I have to talk around this. So first of all, there is the macro to micro motion. That is, what I'm talking about is substances and compounds made in a laboratory versus what's in there on a scale of molecules. That was the greatest conceptual transformation in chemistry in the end of the 19th century. And then the 20th, the growing conviction that the microscopic structure of molecules, even before we knew that structure, before we had any idea of the metrics. You have to remember, this crystal structure of diamond was done just about 100 years ago for the first time during World War I. That was the first time we had the length of a CC bond. The conception that inside were molecules and that their shape affected reactions, transformations of molecules, was a slowly growing construct of late 19th century, I think. That those molecules are quasi-classical objects. So they are like balls connected with springs, maybe, if not sticks. And that, for the most part, the transformations of value, and I mean in value by making molecules of commercial value, let us say, that for the most part we could imagine that in a loosely billiard ball imagination of these little microscopic objects changing in a course of reaction. So that we could imagine SN2 substitution, or we could imagine an aromatic reaction where a cation, an acid, approaches the benzene ring, forms a bond, and the substitution that is involved in making, let us say, nitrobenzene from benzene is a sequence of such reactions. And that you could turn this to practical value. I think the practical value took almost 100 years to turn that. I think steroid transformation are a crucial point in the 20th century. I think steroids are so central to many biological functions. Cortisone, the birth control pills, bile acids, all these things are steroids. And obviously function, the other focus for is things around amphetamine, serotonin, neurotransmitters, rather simple molecules, that you could affect a small change, amphetamine, there, and that you could plan a synthesis of an interesting steroid. And Woodward plays a role in that too, and so does Gerasi in mid-20th century. That was that convinced the community that they could make almost anything in the world organic. And that's where we are right now. So it's important that that way of thinking is in a way, I called it billiard ball, I could call it Lego block. It's a classical, quasi-mechanical, quasi-Newtonian way of the molecular world. But first you had to establish that that kind of way on a microscopic level could affect properties at a macroscopic level. That was the 19th century. I think by the 20th, it's not at all guaranteed that vibrations don't matter. In this whole construction, vibrations don't matter much, though they actually enable the reactions. But in detail, the organic chemists think about this fairly mechanically. So do inorganic chemists.
Well, one other thing I was going to ask, I know you mentioned having spoken to Woodward about whether or not Corey played a role prior
yes.
to the publication, and also that you had spoken to Corey in the wake of the publication.
I didn't speak to them as clearly, to either of them as clearly as I wish I had now.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to put this in the context of the our different status in life and the power relationships.
Right.
I mentioned I was 27 at the time. Corey was 37. Woodward was 47. Woodward was at the top. I was a very bright postdoc.
I was just wondering if, in the wake of the publications, Corey made any contact about the... I mean, I know that he writes something in 2004,
One sentence.
One sentence.
Is what he writes in 2004.
Okay. So there's nothing
that he,
in the interim.
In the interim. Oh, there are other things in the interim which Jeff will detail. So among them, he never talks to Woodward about it.
Okay.
First of all. He apparently talked about it to other people in the Harvard department, who advised him to do nothing. In the period we're doing the work, he obliquely talks to me. It's as if he's trying to talk to Woodward through me, which was, I think, an unethical thing to do, to talk through a student. Effectively. It gives me the sense that he has a stake in the work, but to my memory, he doesn't say so explicitly. My memory is not too good. Maybe that has to do with the war, too. My memory in general is not, except for chemistry, is not that good. Corey writes to me. He has a comment to me that I don't understand at first in the 70s when he visits here, where he says essentially that, he says, I really made your career when I told Woodward story. And at this point, Woodward's still alive. It bursts out of Corey. It obviously eats at him. It's been eating at him all his life. It's a loose way of saying it. But it bursts out of him in a number of ways. He teaches, in the course he teaches in organic chemistry. He says it in the course. And at some point, in the late 60s, some Woodward students are in the course and they go to Woodward and tell him. And he tells them that there's nothing to the story. You know how on a web page of a university there's a little description of the work and a biography of the chemist? A couple of years, 2 or 3 years, I think. I don't know for sure. Corey has that on his entry on the web page, and he takes it off. He writes, finally, in 1981, when Nobel Prize is announced to me and Fukui, Corey writes to me, and those letters are detailed in my article on Angewandte Chemie. And those letters are available. I could show them to you fully. They are on deposit in the Cornell Library, too, in which he essentially accuses Woodward and the second letter, me, of dishonesty and conspiring to keep his contributions quiet. At this point, Woodward is dead 2 years, 1981, dies in 79, age 62. And then, but then Corey, though he has assembled a dossier on the case, on what he sees as evidence of what happened, he does not publish anything on it. He's entreated by Peter Gerlitz and others to respond to my letter to publish his story. He doesn't want to do that. He says what I have said is absolutely true, and there is a pervasive sense of honesty and an ethical stance in Corey's behavior in general. But what he says is when he passes away, that the facts will be revealed. I hope that doesn't happen. In a sense, what I mean is I hope that he tells his side of the story before he passes away, because all he's doing thereby is putting a great burden on his family, which you should not do. I mean, you should face the story yourself, because his family will be faced with the question of whether to publish that, right? What he has to say. He refuses to talk to Seaman. It looks like he will talk to people. I still have hope he'll talk to Jeff Seaman. When the reality of Jeff's publication on this, which is going to take 2 books, as far as I can figure out, comes about, maybe Corey will talk to him. But that's briefly the story. And he occasionally talks to me about.
Yeah. I mean, my proposal would be actually to go into a bit different territory now.
Yeah.
And you mentioned yesterday the importance of this love-hate relationship with computers.
Yes.
And I think that that's a good point.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was also I was going to ask that also in the context of, I mean, you started Cornell in 1965. So you're transitioning to a faculty position. I'm also wondering what Cornell has in terms of computer systems at that time, because I'm not sure how they compare
yes.
to Harvard.
So So Harvard was the place of one of the first computers, but that one, the ENIAC, I think, but that one played no role and was not available to scientific computing. Harvard's and everyone's world was tied to IBM as far as scientific computing goes, and then control data in a while. Cornell's facilities and computing were comparable to those of Harvard. Computing was important to me. I start in 65, so let me a little bit about my history here. I start in 65. I had done the junior fellowship at Harvard. The appointment I was offered here was an associate professor without tenure, rather unusual appointment. But it recognized the junior fellowship years as important. And I did not receive associate professorship. I did not receive tenure till 68, and a year later was promoted to full professor, probably as a result of an offer, one of two offers that I considered seriously in my life, which was from the ETH in Zurich,
oh,
in
wow.
organic chemistry in 68. But that was the top department in the world at that time, one would say. That was Prelog, Eschenmoser, Arrigoni, and Dunitz. Those are pretty incredible people. And I and my wife were Europeans initially, so the cultural shock would not be that great. But for various reasons, we decided not to go. I don't think the ETH people were not, they didn't know how to do it. Didn't invite my wife to come along on the interview. It was things like that. They were operating in a different world. So. But we stayed. I could tell you some of the reasons, but they have to do with Ithaca more than, and with a very collegial department here. The second offer was 1974, jumping ahead a few years from Harvard, which was interesting. Woodward's still very much alive. Corey is certainly an ascending power. There were two poles in the organic department. What was interesting was at the end of the junior fellowship, Lipscomb apparently suggested to the department that they offer me a job at Harvard. But somehow I think the physical chemist didn't think I was, I think I described this Wilson Lipscomb tension. I think that was still 3 years later there. I wasn't offered a job. This is despite 65. I'm working with Woodward and I'm a student of Lipscomb. Two great chemists in that department, but they weren't strong enough to convince the physical chemist to hire me. It would be interesting to see the proceedings of that discussion, if it was there. But so I'm the Harvard offer in 74, I turned that down. I didn't. The only thing I got out of it was the bathroom in back of that wall. I call it the Harvard bathroom. So Cornell said, "What can we do for you?" And I said, "You can match that salary." I wasn't going to go in the end for, again, a variety of reasons, though that had to do a lot with Harvard. I perceived it was a bunch of prima donnas rather than a collegial department, and it didn't make that much of
it. What was the job you were offered? Was it in physical chemistry?
Yes.
Okay.
Theoretical chemistry. Well, there's no great divisional structure in American universities, but yes. So all the characters were still there, but the dynamic had changed, and the work was seen as valuable. I wasn't going to go, but so I said I wanted a bathroom, so I got a bathroom. Anyway, at Cornell, I was quickly promoted to tenure. There was a little episode with one negative letter from Michael Doerr, apparently, on the promotion, but they overcame it. Things went very well here, and I've been very happy here. There was the department's collegio. I've been chairman. We all take turns at being chairman. There's another story about teaching, which is important to me. I taught introductory chemistry half the time by choice, and I like to do that. I taught all kinds of other courses. I developed slowly the interaction with people in the humanities, slowly. It was much easier to do this here than it would have been at Columbia, at Harvard. What happens there is the people don't live near the university. They disperse. And a lot of, if I want to meet someone who is a well-known poet, it would be harder to do it. And I want some, you don't just go over to somebody and say, can you look at my poems? You have to meet them socially first, and then maybe you feel comfortable saying that I also write, and could you take a look at these? And here, Archie Ammons, who was a wonderful poet and became a friend and my guru in poetry, he went to the farmer's market where I went the weekend, and we went to the same coffee shop, and I could meet him. And so this was much easier here. This was a good place to bring up children, which I mentioned. Here you could hope to buy 3 acres of land, 1 hectare around. Imagine buying a hectare of land in Zurich around your house. I mean, it's just, we got used to living in nature. It was nice.
And what is it like establishing yourself as a theoretical chemist at a university? A lot of the people I've interviewed, they talk about setting up a lab and getting graduate students.
Yes.
So what was it like for you establishing yourself? Is there a similar process?
So part of the story is that you're at a major American university. Part of your world is the department. Another part is the world outside. That's true for scientists in general. So the world outside means publishing and getting grants for supportive research. And those are evaluated by people not at your university at all. Not at your university. So I think that balance is an interesting balance. It's tense at times. But the two worlds influence each other. So how your colleagues treat you in terms of a promotion or a salary depends on your reputation outside. That's clear. In terms of physically starting up, it is very much, you get graduate students, and then if you have research grants, you can have postdocs. These days, we supply theoretical chemist even with about $500,000 to begin with, give or take a few dollars, and an experimentalist with $1 million. Where we get that, I don't know, but we do it. Comes from a mixture, and usually as part of that there's actually money for a postdoc for a year or two. I didn't have anything like that, but there was a little money for computing, which was charged at that time. There was no secretarial help. Later I had some from a research grant. I used some money. I bought lots of books. In the beginning we could buy books on our research grants. Later we were not allowed to do that by the government. There was travel money from the research grants. Maybe, and there was one or two instances from university early on. I had my first graduate student within a year, but in the first 5 years, I published more with undergraduates than I did with graduate students. So I quickly learned what you do, and it came with my teaching introductory chemistry. I would pick the best student in the class and offer them a summer job, of course. And I then had a coworker for 3 years. It was wonderful. And there were some very good people in that group. I don't think I published a paper with a graduate student until 4 years here. It just takes time for a graduate student to tool up. There were postdocs among the first of, I mentioned, 22 German ones was Rolf Gleiter, who was then a professor at Heidelberg. Two professors at Heidelberg, Gleiter and actually three were postdocs or visitors here. Rolf Gleiter, Peter Hoffmann, and Lenz Sederbaum. These were good people. Anyway, Sederbaum was actually just a visitor, not a postdoc. We developed the beginnings of a research group, I would say, within about 3 years. The group varied in size from nothing in the beginning to about 10 people. 10 people counts the postdocs, graduate students, and one or two undergraduates at all times. Right now, after retirement, my group has gone down by choice, and it's now at 4 people. Postdocs.
How was the division of labor, if there was any? Did you have to cover certain specialties, certain methodologies in the group? Or was everybody doing almost the same thing, but just at different levels of expertise? Could you describe that a bit?
Yes. So I'll say by way of background that an interesting question is, what is the secret of success of American graduate education in chemistry, or in science in general? And I think some element, and the background for that question is, at the end of high school, the typical European gymnasium graduate is 2 years ahead of the American one. At the end of the university, still 2 years ahead, at age 22, 23. The reason being different is that we have a liberal arts education, and in Germany they're studying all chemistry, or in Japan. So at the beginning of a PhD in chemistry, at age 23, typically, 22, 23, the American is 2 years behind, I would say. By the end of the PhD, they've caught up. And in part, the PhD here is longer. It takes typically 5 years. In Europe, it is often 3 years. In part, it is that we have very well-structured courses, actually, as part of the PhD at the beginning. Not too many, but very. And the second part, I think, the hidden part, is the structure of group meetings and a scientific group. And this is, we have two a week, lasting for typically 2 to 3 hours each. We didn't have one. A lot of things go on. We didn't have one yesterday, but we usually do. But we had one, an extra one the day before. Every group is different, but there is, some groups are very structured so that people are assigned to report on their work at regular intervals, or they have assigned certain journals to bring an article from, a literature. My group were not structured. I just asked, has somebody seen anything in the literature? And if they don't bring something in for 6 weeks, I go and talk to them and say, you should bring it in. And they listen. But we talk about some research. I bring some things from the literature. later this afternoon, one of the people has got an interview for a job in Canada for an assistant professor. He's going to practice his talk on us. We do that. Everything. It's in those group meetings that I will make a comment. This work is a piece of crap. And this is, even though that work is supported by the National Science Foundation and published in JACS. So the students, and I will say it other times, this is really nice. And the students get an idea of informal evaluation of quality in science. And they get sharp criticism of their presentations, and they get, it's actually a wonderful structure. So the research group, there is no, within the research group, you asked a little different question. And that is, how is the work sort of apportioned? And I've always operated on a principle that everybody in the group knows what everybody else is doing. And they help each other. So I give them grief if they tell me that I couldn't get this program to work, or I couldn't get it to give this particular indicator out of the computer software, and I find out that they didn't ask somebody in the group about how to do it. Usually they do ask, and they learn. So we're very collective. The papers often involve two people in a group, at least, but sometimes not, and there are divisions by subject. I like to have each person working on more than one problem at a time. I just think it's more efficient to, if they run into a problem on one, then they shift to the other. It's just and when they come, I ask them, do you want to work on something? And is there something you want to work on? And if they give me something reasonable, I will say yes, because we work on we essentially work on anything except biochemical molecules, organic, inorganic, solid state. Sometimes then they will ask me, and then I say, if they don't have anything, then I give them a choice of two or three projects, and they usually choose one or two to work on. So there are some, the two or three, I those colored folders up there are projects, some groups of papers about something that I think is worth working on. Others come up from visitors coming by, from letters, from the literature. We are often in a mode of solving bonding puzzles, something weird in the geometry of a molecule or a reaction. And my general feeling is that everything in the world is connected to everything else. That's something I try to teach them, so that it doesn't matter what we begin to work on, going to be connected to something else. So I have a lot of trouble with mission-oriented research, like working on hydrogen storage or working on better batteries. I have occasionally accepted some, not accepted, I've tried to get some money for those things, but I've been fortunate most of the life to get support from the NSF to work on any molecule under the sun. This is a great luxury. But we have a track record for the connections and for getting something interesting out of it.
How do you establish these connections? I mean, I understand that you start with very specific molecules, maybe with unusual geometry.
Maybe.
And I understand also that you need quite a bit of expertise in certain class of compounds. I mean, some groups just work, as you told us, about glutamines, right? About porphyrins.
Yes.
They're alive. Obviously, you do almost the opposite. Any molecule
yes.
under the sun.
Any molecule under the sun.
What is the common denominator? What is the? How do you build these bridges in
so
the group?
In common. So I have to tell you some case studies for that, but I think the common denominator is that I'm building a worldview of little pieces of theory that explain structure and reactivity fundamentally. Though recently I've been interested in something like superconductivity, which is a property, maybe. But structure, okay, reactivity, properties. And gluing it together is, I guess, an orbital view that I believe that it's the electrons in the molecules. And I want to see how that is played out. In, I think that's the glue that holds them together. But I'll give you two case studies. Where things went along a line, and one is one that we're involved in just right now, a connection with these nitroxide radicals. Started from a very physical chemistry, chemical physics problem that a new postdoc in the group came from Canada, though he is Chinese, Tao Zeng. He came with his own money and is working together with me and a new assistant professor, Nandini Anand. And Tao and Nandini decided we would work on singlet fission. Okay, so now singlet fission is a very hot phenomenon now, driven by solar energy conversion. And there is the normal way that solar energy conversion operates is you excite a molecule with the sunlight. That molecule passes on the excitation in a crystal or in a liquid to an interface. It does it by the excitation. One molecule excited, next molecule ground state, and then the exciton forms, that exciton that I worked on in Russia in 1965. The excitation switches to the second molecule. The first molecule goes back to the ground state. Then it goes on. It migrates. The exciton migrates. Goes to an interface where the excited state transfers an electron to an acceptor molecule, typically a fullerene. And the electron goes off with the fullerene as a negative charge, and what's left behind is a positive charge on the molecule. So essentially, an excited state is split into an electron and a hole. The two propagate, they generate the current. That's the principle of now of solar cell construction. A chromophore to capture the energy, migration of the energy to an interface, the creation of an ion pair, and that's the current. There's a natural limit on the efficiency of this of 35% for thermodynamic reasons. A way to surpass that limit is what singlet fission is. In singlet fission, you make an excited singlet state of a molecule, a normal thing, by absorption of light, visible light. And then that singlet state generates, interacting with a neighboring molecule, generates a two triplet states. Not doesn't transfer the excitation, but if you think the first molecule goes down from the singlet to the triplet, which is a typical thing, but at the same time, the second molecule goes up to a triplet, you have to have a thermodynamic condition that the energy of the singlet is twice the energy of the triplet, otherwise this won't work. This is called singlet fission, meaning that a singlet state divides into two triplets. The two triplets then migrate. And so this is a way of getting two photons out of one.
Do you double the efficiency then for that?
Not quite, but you surpass the previous limit. This has been shown experimentally. So what molecule would do this? So that there was one probed experimentally, which is the workhorse right now of the solar cells that are being designed, and it's pentacene, five benzene rings in a row. And we wanted to see how pentacene works, how this triplet fission works. First, and then in the second paper, which we've published two papers, one last year, one this year. The second paper, we design alternatives to pentacene, which will give singlet fission. And in the first paper, I had a minor part. That problem was brought to me by the postdoc. And I would say overall I had a minor part, but I made it, I clarified some things, helped them along. I would say of the three authors, I deserve less than one third of the credit. In the second paper, in the design of new small molecules, we identified a property of the pentacene molecule that makes it meet the singlet fission criterion, that the singlet should be twice the energy of the triplet. The identification was not original to me. It was due to Josef Michal and to a Japanese group. Or at least they made a tentative connection between between the diradical character of the molecule and the singlet fission. The explanation is a little complicated, but a diradical means two unpaired electrons, and then they would give, the ground state would be, what a diradical guarantees is a low-lying triplet. Because a diradical, the triplet and the singlet, the two ways of coupling the spins are about the same energy. And so, what we don't want, we want a singlet ground state, a low-lying triplet, and a high-lying next singlet. Somehow, mixing in some diradical character, but not entirely diradical, is what makes this. It was in some equations that a Japanese group wrote, but I don't think they didn't think of using it, but Josef Michal did, and I thought that we could induce this diradical character by some substituting two carbons, by boron and nitrogen. And I loved this BN substitution. I had done a first paper on it, going back to my boron hydride days with Lipscomb. It worked in this paper, so that was the second paper. We have three candidates, small molecule candidates for singlet fission. We know of two groups around the world that are trying to make it. What I can bring to this also is the realism of 50 years experience that I can predict which molecules might be actually persistent, stable in a colloquial way of looking at it. So then what I'm doing is I've got a new way of thinking about molecules, and that is I'm thinking about molecules that have substantial diradical character, meaning that a triplet is close to a singlet. And I begin reading about, I don't know how I got there, about, I'm thinking about stability, I'm thinking, and so I pick up a paper which talks about stable free radicals. And that paper talks about these radicals stabilized by what's called captodative stabilization. It's a word. Captodative means, capto is acceptor, dative is donor. So it's a pi system, like imagine allyl, and here is the radical site, and here I put a donor, and here an acceptor. So this could be BH2. And that we used in that second paper. I begin to think about stabilizing radicals by donor and acceptor. Then I started reading about what stabilizes radicals in general, and I find these nitroxyl radicals, which are NORR, which are stable, and I'm trying to figure out why they are stable. But while I'm trying to figure out why they are stable, I have a new postdoc, a different postdoc from the first one, and her chemical background is poor. She has done calculations, her PhD is from Iowa State, with a very good group, but on very abstruse theoretical problems. So to get her going, I ask her to do some calculations on two nitroxyls, a diradical formed from two of these hooked together. I thought maybe it would be interesting to make two of these, put them in a five-membered ring. I'm thinking like an organic chemist, and then I'm thinking of coupling the two, and what I'm trying to generate is from two unpaired electrons, a triplet and a singlet, I'm trying to generate a diradical. I think of this as just as an exercise mainly for her to get some chemical experience. Connects up to some work of somebody else in a group. And then she's slow in moving in this. And so I think, why are these radicals so stable? They are so stable because the dimerization product of the two has a very weak bond. So I say, study the dimerization of the nitrosyls. She does, of the nitroxides. She does that and gets that instead of forming a full bond, they are sitting close to each other, but both of these are long. So there's a partial bond. I think we'll have a paper out of this. The problem has been changed from singlet fission, pentosine, through seeing a diradical in it, migrated from one postdoc to another postdoc, and we have something on the dimerization of nitroxyls, which I never would have worked on before. But this is part of the dynamic of the problem being migrated. In this case, the part of the dynamic is also chemical physics, solar energy cells, to organic chemistry, stable free radicals. These nitroxides, nitroxyls, have they use the spin labels. People build them into a biological molecule in one place, and then they can study the ESR of that, and they can get some idea of the conformation. You know, I couldn't care less about that. But it's interesting that it's used. I know that I could write an NIH proposal around those things, but I'm not going to do it. I'm interested in the same radicals as something totally different.
So, I'm not sure if you want to speak more about your transition from organic to inorganic around 75. If you do, I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, there is... it's not that I was tired of organic chemistry. After the orbital symmetry story, I went into looking at the electronic structure of various, or most of the likely intermediates in organic reactions. This meant especially carbenes, carbonium ions, enzymes. That work went very well. I very quickly got into, somehow that way, into thinking about molecules that don't exist, that is, making predictions of molecules that would be made, possibly. And one of the early sort of interesting success stories was a 1970 paper where I don't know what got into me, but I said, what can we do to make methane planar instead of tetrahedral? So there is an article called Square Planar Carbon. This has not been, so what we did in that paper is, it was an example of the utility of MO theory. That is, we, as I would say it, one of the very, very, very few advantages of theory over experiment is that you can do calculations on molecules that are unhappy in some way energetically, just as easily, really, just as badly, as you can do on calculations that are happy. Of course, and there are people who do this, but of course now the chemistry comes in. Of course you do this in order to devise, it's not to judge how unhappy planar methane is relative to tetrahedral. The answer is 100 kilocalories, which is greater than the strength of a CH bond, or about equal. So, and it's not even a minimum on a potential energy surface, actually pyramidalizes to a C4B structure. The purpose, of course, is to alleviate its unhappiness. That is, to devise, to use that knowledge of the unhappiness energetic of the molecule to devise a strategy for making it happier and still retaining that unusual feature. And that became a kind of leitmotif for other things. We stumbled into it, but it's right there in the beginning. We calculate methane square planar, we look at its orbitals, and we design then a strategy which involves it attaching pi acceptors and sigma donors as substituents. That has generated probably, there are some approaches theoretical. No one has made such a molecule. There are a few molecules, organometallics, that have this. Nothing very stable. But it's generated food for theoreticians. There have been a few hundred papers trying to accomplish this. that was lots of fun, and I've done that again in some other things. But the first time I stumbled into it. Even right now, we are thinking about something else which is equally unlikely. And that is, what can we do to a methane to convert it in, to keep it tetrahedral, but to make it a triplet ground state? The answer is two very electronegative substituents, two very electropositive, gets very near. And we are, so a carbon with two lithiums and two fluorines on it is getting close. These are not your normal molecules. They're not going to be made in gram quantities and so on. But in a matrix isolation experiment, maybe they can be studied. I went from organic to inorganic, in part because I came from inorganic, from the boron hydrides. But boy, there are light years between boron hydrides and transition metal complexes. Though that has been bridged, there have been boron hydrides made which have transition metals incorporated. But transition metal chemistry to me was clearly a field. There's another interesting story where, in which symmetry considerations and orbitals were there before organic chemistry. And so that's another story, that they thought of the 3 below 2 splitting of an octahedral complex and drew out the orbitals for that before the orbital symmetry story.
Who's they?
They is a story that the crystal field theory was invented by Hans Bethe, actually, with Cornell connection, in a PhD thesis in 1929, early days of quantum mechanics. Very important was Van Vleck, and still a physicist in the United States, and in Germany, Hartmann was a very active period. Then there was crystal field theory, and molecular orbital versions of it were lost for a while from importance, revived very fundamentally, probably crucially, by Ballhausen in Denmark, and also Klitspøl-Jørgensen in part, in another Dane working elsewhere. And then revived really in the early 60s by Leslie Orgel in a very influential textbook. Orgel went on to be a molecular biologist, so just died recently. Christopher Longett Higgins played some small part in this too. Ballhausen, Gray, Harry Gray, Orgel played essential roles in that. And it coincided also with the rediscovery of organometallics and the ferrocene synthesis of many derivatives. So that's another story. So I had the inorganic influence of boron hydride. There came to Cornell Earl Mutates, who is no longer alive, who then went on to Berkeley, left here. But for 10 years, we worked together on first, on mainly main group, PF5, pentacoordinate phosphorus, was of interest. Gave me an idea of stereochemistry, organometallics. I then started on transition metals, more or less myself, that didn't come from these guys. That was the first paper of 74. I think by 1980 we were fully into the electronic structure of organometallics with some very talented postdocs. And you will notice that I did something unconventional in a Nobel lecture. I did not talk about the orbital symmetry work, but I talked about an isolobal analogy as a bridge between organometallic and inorganics. I thought that was in the spirit of Woodward, but anyway, by that time, At the same time, we developed around 1980 the facility to do electronic structure of extended systems, meaning minerals, metals, and things like the solid state compounds. But I worked on that, I would say, desultorily in the next 20 years, and then that took over.
What does facility mean in this regard? You mentioned the facility to deal with these extended structures. What
that means in this case, one hand it meant programs to do this. Really what it meant was learning the language of solid state physics. And one of the few books, science books I've written is called Solids and Surfaces, and it's about that. So this is learning the language of Brillouin zones, of reciprocal space, of band structures, of Fermi levels. It's the language of solid state physics. And we came into it from orbitals, and I could see how one moved from orbitals of individual molecules to chains of molecules to the infinite solid. And the physicists didn't see it that way. They saw what they did instead was they did an infinite solid, free electrons, and they put on the perturbation of the atoms on the free electrons. And my thing was putting it together from the pieces. I slowly rediscovered all of solid state physics, but I had a bridge then between the solid state physics. This is why when Michal asked me to write something for Heritage, I wrote about building passerelles, it was called. It was about bridges, building bridges between organic and inorganic, and between chemistry and physics. And in another way, maybe there is another bridge to the humanities that I'm trying. It's not a design. I'm playing out this luxury of following whatever I want to follow.
How did you do that with solid state physics? I mean, we are now around 1980, I guess.
Yes. That's when I began.
Solid state physics, of course, at that time was a very established field.
I know.
Hard to penetrate in a way. And how did you deal with that? Whom did you talk to, if you talked to someone? How did that happen?
I talked to a few people. More recently, I've been talking much more seriously with a leading physicist who written one of the great textbooks of solid state physics, Ashcroft and Merman. And Neil Ashcroft and I have joined research groups around the high pressure area, which is one of my recent interests. In the beginning, I talked to a few chemists who had already were working on that frontier. And they were Mike Sienko here, my colleague who died in 81. It was just near the beginning. And there was Arne Simon, who was just retired from the Max Planck Institute for Festkörper Physik at Stuttgart. He was a good friend, and we talked about things. I did it on my own. I think I discovered a molecular orbital way of doing solid state physics, and I learned it by examples of molecules and classes of molecules that we did. Just as I learned perturbation theory in the orbital symmetry days, not knowing the formalism initially, not understanding it in practice, from the practice itself, reinventing the same thing. It's just the way it works for me. It's just lots of fun to to penetrate the field that way. So then I wrote, I combined two articles, the only two scientific books I've written, and this is a certain regret that I haven't written more, are both come from articles, the one with Woodward, the long article on Angewandte Chemie, it's reprinted in book form. I similarly took two articles and now, not just reprinting, combined them, one from Angewandte Chemie, one from Reviews of Modern Physics. So I was able to publish our chemical view of surfaces in this orbital way, eventually in Reviews of Modern Physics, which is, so I was, but that, even that publication is prefaced by a comment by the editor saying, here is something interesting from a well-known chemist, and he has not quite the usual way of the looking at this physics stuff, but we'll let him publish it. Not exactly, but there's a little of the tone it is in there is like that. I took these articles, I put them in a book, and the purpose of that book was, that book has about two equations in it. The rest are pictures of orbitals and lots of graphs. And the idea is to, there are two, I had a twofold idea. I said one was to teach chemists not to be afraid of the language of solid state physics. And second was to show to physicists that chemical ideas of bonds and orbitals have significance for doing solid state physics. And what I can say now, and what I do say in some talks, is in the first aim, I have succeeded. There are now two generations of solid state chemists working on high temperature superconductors, on magnetic materials, on all these things, who have learned that language from my book, have learned not to be afraid of solid state physics. In the second aim, convincing physicists that there's something of value in the chemical way of looking at bonding for extended materials, nothing. Nada. Rien. No reaction whatsoever. So that just tells you something about physics and chemistry, and I think in part we are dealing here with the effects of reductionism in practice. But the solid-state physics community is the one so closest to chemistry and the one least susceptible to reductionism compared to elementary particle physics or something like that. It's been lots of fun of interacting with physics, and the high-pressure community has given me a new playground. The behavior of matter under high pressure. It's not just graphite going into diamond, but also that you get entirely new phases of matter. So lithium and beryllium form no compounds at one atmosphere. There is not a one-to-one compound. It's not like there is no alloy. Yes, there are actually solutions of one and the other. But under pressure, you get four phases that are thermodynamically stable under pressure. One of them has been that we made a prediction of. There is some sign of it. The prediction really hasn't been verified. But there is a chance for making some verifiable predictions for. And recently we had a little bit of luck where a prediction we made on benzene under pressure, organic chemistry now under pressure. The pressures I'm talking about are not the routine pressures of an industrial Haber-Bosch process, which are 300 to 500 atmospheres. The chemical industry can sell you a reactor operating at 500 atmospheres today. We are talking about pressures at the center of the Earth, which is 3.5 million atmospheres. You can can study those experimentally by taking two diamonds between polished flat faces of gem quality diamonds in a little cell that is about this size. Two diamonds, a hard metal gasket, a ring with a hole drilled in it. You put in the sample, you diamonds above and below. The whole thing put in a hydrostat, in a mechanical press, which takes about this, the height of this room. You can reach 3.5 million atmospheres in a reaction space of about a tenth of a millimeter cubed. Still macroscopic, but
how do you study your stuff in there?
We're lucky it's diamonds that you have to use because they're transparent.
So you use spectroscopies?
You can do the following. You can do X-ray spectroscopy. You can do X-ray diffraction in a limited angle range because the diamond is a cone, sort of roughly. That's how it's polished. You can do Raman and some infrared. UV doesn't work too well. Can't do NMR. You can study, you can put you can attach electrodes so you can study conductivity. So a lot of the evidence comes from X-ray diffraction and Raman. An interesting question is, how do you know what pressure is in there? So what you do is you throw in some tiny ruby crystals into the reaction chamber. The ruby is an impurity of chromium in alumina, I think. I don't know. Forget now which. The chromium is in oxidation state where there is a chemical gauge of the pressure. There is a 3 below 2 splitting going back to Hans Bethe again, a crystal field splitting of the levels in an octahedral field. And the electron is jumping in the ruby color that we see. The electron is jumping between these D levels. The pressure changes the spacing between these two levels. So the color of the rubies changes. And that has been independently calibrated. But I think it's amusing that the chemistry crystal field of chromium is used to measure pressure at 3.5 million atmospheres. Xenon can be made metallic. That has been shown. Just imagine that. It doesn't surprise you that xenon can be made a solid. Anything under pressure becomes a solid. Just under pressure, all that matters is get closer together. So translated into science, that means the higher density. So why does graphite go to diamond? Because the density of diamond is bigger than the density of graphite. So when you compress, eventually it dries over there. Anyway, any gas can be made under pressure solid. First goes liquid, then solid. But then you compress it still further for xenon, and the energy levels of the xenon begin to overlap and you get a metal. But that's when you see that, you really think there's something interesting.
Now you're talking almost like an experimentalist.
I know. So part of the secret of my success is I am underneath a chemist who is hiding as a theorist. Well, I'm just joking, but I can say it another way. I told you before, had someone exposed me to an inspiring organic course when I was an undergraduate, I'm sure I would have become a synthetic organic chemist. I just like the complexity. I just told you a story about the nitroxyls. It involves a journey from pentosine to diradicals to nitroxyls. Many theoreticians, it's not that they won't undertake that journey if the funding money is there or if there is a reason. The solar energy people would much rather work with a small molecule, but it is penthesine and not the small molecule that undergoes this phenomenon. So you study penthesine going to fullerene, but you know, I don't think they don't have this chemist, and I guess it's organic chemist point of view, that the world out there is made out of tunable things that we can make. So if the molecule isn't quite right, we change it. And I got that confidence from talking to Woodward, that I got the confidence that organic chemists can make anything in the world by a Lego construction technique, to come to tie back to the other thing, which in itself is a very classical view of chemistry, but that has worked. I appreciate the other things too, but I think that that's the true beauty of organic chemistry, the sort of infinite tunability of properties that we can get. And I mentioned steroids, I mentioned amphetamine, that skeleton there. What a difference in a steroid by putting a methyl group there. I mean, that's the difference between testosterone and one of the female sex hormones. It's just a methyl group. And nature has one of those female sex hormones is a precursor of testosterone. And another one follows from the biosynthesis processing of testosterone. So nature has made all of these, and evolution has found the ways for these processes and to control them. So interesting. So the real joy is that 54 years down the line, if we count from, where are we? We have to count from 1960 when I came back from Russia, so that the next molecule down the line in the journal still remains a lot of fun. But I also find new things in them as I go along.
How did you find out about Woodward's death?
I believe a colleague, a friend, his Elkin Blount called me. He was a close friend. He may have lived in the same apartment building. He was 62. He had stopped smoking finally about 2 years before, so there must have been. I never asked him about that. Why he stopped, so it must have been some medical episode where a doctor told him, because he certainly didn't, the popular wisdom about the dangers of smoking. He had smoked 2-3 packs of cigarettes a day all his life. We had we had a close relationship with some interruption of work together, and then a period near the end of his life where we worked on something together again. I'll tell you about that. And that was published, a paper, and then a lot of things that are not published, that came out recently. So what happened was, we did those five communications in 1965. The first submitted in 64. 1985 was the year I came here. So that the actually the last of these public communications, last two, were submitted when I was already here. We worked for another 4 years on the long paper in Angewandte. And we have original things in that paper. And somehow we perfected a way of looking at things that we that allowed us to see things in a different way. So even though everyone and his brother jumped into the field among theoreticians, most of the time, and this is something which Seaman will detail too, without exception, they were so obsessed with good people, which showing somehow that the same results could be gotten in another way, or, as in the case of Dürer, that they had obtained the same results, or that they could have been obtained. That none of them went on to apply those results to things we had not published. One of them was anterofacial cycloadditions, where you added to an ethylene component on opposite sides in a cycloaddition, how to affect that. There were a few other things. So we published that paper, and at that point, that was 69. We did not do a piece of work together for 8 years. And I went off into these organic intermediates and inorganic. Woodward kept on working. The B12 synthesis was done. There were some other synthetic things. We ran into a little bit of trouble in a personal relationship around 1970 when we were at a meeting in Karlsruhe. And aside from smoking, he was a drinker and he was well known, and he made a fetish out of this, of drinking a bottle of scotch while he was giving a lecture. But also drinking with students at parties. I don't think he was an alcoholic, but he drank a lot. So at this meeting in Karlsruhe, he gave these lectures traditionally, which lasted, I've only heard two, lasted 4 or 5 hours. And at the Karlsruhe, someone put out a bottle of scotch on the desk while he was. And he drank from it, and it was made a big show of someone. He said, "Please pour me some more," and so on. It was a kind of teenage bravado almost, but he was not a teenager. But at some point, I wanted to say to the person who was pouring, "Don't do that, please." But it would have been too much. I didn't have the courage. And then afterwards, the talk lasted maybe an hour longer than it should have because the effects of the alcohol showed up. Afterwards, I said to him, "Let me drive you home." And he said, "No, no," and he insisted on driving me. He had his car there. I was going to take a taxi. I said, "Let's take a taxi home." And he said, "No, no," and he insisted on driving me in home to the hotel. And I felt so bad about myself not being strong enough to tell him to stop the drinking and to not drive, or to that afterwards, I think that was a little bit of a breaking point. Maybe just as well, because I needed to establish my reputation in some way. Independent, and I did through these papers. Then around 77, he called me up and told me about design of organic conductors. And we worked on that, and that was one of the first papers where we had, we wrote a program for doing extended structures. We had an early calculation of graphene in there, but we wrote a paper, which was part of the proceedings of the Royal Society about this, together with a very brilliant postdoc I had who wrote the programs, about the electronic structure of various two-dimensional systems. And there was much more from conversations. There were hundreds of pages of writings and drawings by him, and we published those recently. I don't know if you saw that. So let me show you, because they're quite incredible documents. Those drawings and papers were on his desk in 1979 when he died, and we would have done more. They were on the design of organic conductors and superconductors. The family, Woodward's family, took away those papers. They did hundreds of pages of drawings. Did not leave them there. It was their right to do so. But the reason they took them away, and they did nothing with them, well, that's not quite true. They gave them to some people. They thought there was something of commercial value there. The usual thing that drives families. But of course, to exploit it was difficult. In the end, they have preserved them. They're on paper that's decaying. And they gave the papers to Michael Kava, an organic chemist working on organic conductors, to edit them. He started to write this up together with a postdoc. And both he and a postdoc died. Now we have three dead people and one body of these papers. And they came to Bob Williams and me, and then the family came and asked, could you write something about it? So we edited the cover paper. Let me see. This was published in Tetrahedron. R.B. Woodward's Unfinished Symphony. So it has Kava and a postdoc and me and Bob Williams on this. Yeah. And we edited, Kava talks about the science. Oh, come on. Don't know what I did, but and it's illustrated by reproductions.
This by his own?
Yes.
These drawings?
Woodward's, this is Woodward's drawings, hand drawings. Wait till you see this.
Oh, wow.
So we actually did some history of science here.
Sure.
And these are the, he's writing these polymers and he's counting electrons. There's more. Classical yellow paper, this is very acid full and it's decaying rapidly. This is marginally better, turning yellow. Here's more.
They are beautiful.
They are. Here are some of the polymers he designed. Where we could, we illustrated with his drawing because it was. They are so attractive.
Yeah.
Numerology. You can see the paper decaying here. So sad. that. He did this by hand. Little.
He was an artist, right?
Yes, his daughter has written a thesis about him being an artist.
Hmm.
He thought of architecture, certainly, and he was very good at drawing. We have saved these papers, and in an appendix we have a lot of these drawings. Look at these, they're just so cr- the meticulous nature of these things, how he carefully sketches these things. Look at that, the orbitals. He took a compass to write these.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't use a template for this. You can see the hexagons are not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
He had the Angewandte Chemie, the old template, because he and I used it extensively. But he didn't. He sketched these. He's doing calculation of the total space filled by the atoms of iron. He loved algebra. I'm so happy we got this published. There are 600 pages like this.
So he had this on his desk when he died?
Yeah.
So you were in close contact again?
Among these, I came during that period and we worked on that paper. Among the 600 pages are two or three pages of mine. And the family thought it was his.
Hmm.
But it's very funny because we have, I then was able to, this here, you notice the difference, this is mine.
Calculation there.
Well, there's some calculation, there's
yeah.
some sketching
yeah,
or something.
Sure.
But it's not as neat as his. But that was the last thing, we just throw it in as a little.
So that's tetrahedron published?
Published.
In 2011, okay.
Yes, 2011 tetrahedron.
We certainly looked that up.
So that period was a period of renewed work between Woodward and me on organic conductors connected to my growing interest in extended materials and his. He came to me again, essentially, for. And we got one long paper for it, out of it. There could have been more, and since then people have made some of these nets, but they're not aware that Woodward suggested them. Many have not been made. So he died in 79, the Nobel Prize was 81. There's no question that he would have shared in the Nobel Prize, because our names were. It was collaborative work. We knew we had been nominated for it because there's an amusing story, two stories. One is, the people who nominate you for Nobel Prizes cannot resist telling you about this. The reason they think that some of it rubs off on them or something, the weird psychology. The second thing was the Japanese, like the French and a number of other countries, have well-oiled institutions to nominate every possible person from that country who has a chance for the Nobel Prize. There are only about 1,000 people each year who can do the nomination. They are the members of the Swedish Academy of Sciences, the Scandinavian Academies of Science, former Nobel laureates, and about 300, 400 people who are chosen on a rotating basis from the full professors of departments around the world. They are the nominators. Anyway, the Japanese committee entrusted with this, in typical Japanese fashion, came to Woodward one day, three Japanese scientists said, may we speak to you? Appointment was made. And they came to him to ask for his permission to nominate us together with Fukui.
That's kind.
very Japanese. And Woodward received them, gave them a drink, and it was all very formal. He called me afterwards, and we both agreed it was very Japanese. But it was so they had decided that Fukui had a chance, and they were right.
How did you find out officially? I mean, you knew that you were being nominated.
We were nominated for a number of years. In the beginning, it's exciting, and you begin to listen on the day of the announcements, which was not that well known, and as it is now. Now it's the day it's announced. After a few years, so we knew we had been nominated. Maybe 6-7 years before. After a while, if you are able, depending on your psychology, this is another story. Depending on your psychology, you realize in the mix of psychology and rationality, you realize that the realities of winning a Nobel Prize, that it's a chance event with some quasi-political overtones at the top. Let me put it another way. The Nobel Prize was just given for single molecule photochemistry. Of course, the days before, people asked me, journalists and other, who do you think is going to get the Nobel Prize? So for a friend I could show you, I made up a list of 8 groups or areas, because it is very clear that they is five Swedes, which is the Nobel Committee, which makes a recommendation to the chemistry section of the Nobel Academy, which then makes a recommendation to the full membership. But as far as I know, once in the last 100 years has the full membership rejected a recommendation by this committee. There's essentially 5 Swedes who decide. There's a rotating committee. Their identity is known. They're amusing beneficiaries then of invitations from the countries that have that committee to recognize. There's all kinds of politics going on. Anyway, I made a list for my friend of 8 groups, and they were not the ones who were chosen. The ones who were chosen were not among the 8. Okay, so after you realize that, you let go of it. I think it's interesting, it can happen, but there are some people in this world who become so obsessed with this that they cannot let go. And that's all the... What can one tell them? Go see a psychologist. It's not a way to run your life, to become obsessed by this. Anyway, we knew we were... But on the day it happened, I was at home. Okay, the other part of the process is the news, the decision, is leaked by the Swedish Academy to a Swedish newspaper or two, so that they can call first. In the old days, they would send a telegram. In my days, they still send telegrams. So the Swedish Academy leaks it to a Swedish newspaper, so usually people find out by a call from the Swedish newspaper. That newspaper had trouble getting me. I think they must have called the wrong Hoffman. My wife said that she had some inkling because a friend of ours, a Swedish scientist, so we have a this was something special for us because of the Swedish connection. So since I speak Swedish, I could speak in Swedish to the royal family and other people. There's another interesting story, but anyway, the Swedish newspaper failed to call me, though they actually called Fukui. The reason my wife was suspicious was that a Swedish scientist has asked for my picture. Hmm. And this was later turned out that was a member of the Nobel Committee. So there must have been something. But she didn't tell me about it, which is just as well. I found out I was at home. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. It was a little, I don't know why it was so, no, it must have been earlier because there was only, usually the committee decisions at noon, but I don't know. Anyway, I heard it on the radio. I was fixing my bicycle in a garage and I had the radio on to listen to the news. And I didn't know it was the day, and I heard it. I immediately ran in and called my mother. You heard about my mother before, why it was important, before the calls would start coming in, and they did, but I was lucky. So, unfortunately, my stepfather had died 2 months before, so it was a sad time in the family, but of course my mother was very happy.
What did she say? Do you remember?
Don't know. She was very happy. She always, like mothers everywhere, there's a Yiddish word for it, naches, comes from a Hebrew word, not from a German one. It means for the joy your children bring you. Rather interesting expression. In most languages, you'd need a few words for that, but there is a single Yiddish word for that, to bring naches. She was very happy.
Who came with you to Stockholm?
We spent some money bringing some family there. The only closest living relative on my father's side is brother Yehuda from Israel and his wife. The only one living of the people who were in the attic was my uncle Frank, came. My sister Eleanor, our children, of course. Also, my stepfather was not alive, as I said, he died, but his sister, Giza, came, we brought there. So it was a rather small family group, and it was people who had close family from three families, my mother's, my father. And then we had a very large Swedish local contingent. We hired a boat and had a party the day after, 2 days after, on a boat. This is not December, but Eva's family lives on an island outside of Stockholm, and we couldn't quite get into the bay where they live. The island's connected by a bridge, it's very well connected, but we took this boat out to this island with a big band on it. It cost $10,000 to hire the boat, but it's okay. We had a good party for the Swedish relatives and the other ones who came along with some music. But the setting was, it was almost, there was just an icebreaker in to open up a channel in this bay, in this island, which was frozen over. It's lots of fun. We had a good time. The Nobel Prize winner in literature that year was Elias Canetti, who was a complicated history, Bulgarian, Austrian, lived in London, novelist writing in German. Turns out Elias Canetti has a PhD in analytical chemistry. And but he also, he tells it in his autobiography, he did it to please his mother. Another story. He tells the story well, but even while he was getting the PhD, he was sitting in a cafe in Vienna in the 20s and writing his great novel, Auto da Fe. I asked him, what did chemistry mean to you? What did it contribute anything to your writing? And he said, it gave me a sense of structure. And I don't think he meant chemical structure in the sense that we have talked about, but he meant that things were related to each other, that there was an order. That was an interesting comment. And so that was 1981. I was 44, which was very young for a Nobel laureate. Very young. Fukui was older. He's no longer alive. That's his picture from there. He was came from an old Japanese aristocratic family. He had much more difficulty with the Nobel Prize than I, because he was the first Japanese Nobel Prize winner, and he was shy and retiring by nature, and he was pushed into positions of public pronunciations and things in Japan, which were, they just made more of a fuss about it for natural reasons. The first Nobel laureate in chemistry in Japan, been number since. He and I got along very well from the beginning. We have not published anything together, but four of his students came as postdocs with me over the years.
Before the Nobel or after both?
Before. And we have published, and they have become some of the leaders of Japanese science, all theoreticians, very well trained. Imamura, Fujimoto, Yoshizawa, and Tatsumi. So we have visited there. We've had, I would say, very good connections. I think the reality is that our work shed light and gave importance to what Fukui did. And Fukui's frontier orbital ideas, we used them intuitively earlier on, and they grew into prominence in my own work later on. And his being Japanese did not hurt, probably, in the deliberations of the Nobel Committee. To this day, if you can produce among the 100 or so people who deserve a Nobel Prize, if you can produce a nomination that has as many non-Americans as possible, it's likely to do better than a nomination which is all American. that's my judgment of the quasi-political situation. I have used it myself in constructing nominations.
What did it mean to you?
It meant, officer was very nice. It was very nice for my mother. I wish my stepfather had lived. For the family, it was. So, I wasn't the only Jewish emigre scientist to get the Nobel Prize. This was, so many were produced. Hitler's gifts to America, one way to say it. Amazing flowering of talent. On one hand, taking advantage, there were many more advanced scientists who did not, who could not reestablish themselves professionally in America. There's an interesting story there. You find some of those in the histories of German biochemists that Lothar Jenicke were connected to Ute Deichmann, because Ute was in Lothar's department. Lothar Jenicke has written these remarkable and not easy to read biographies of German Jewish biochemists in two volumes. Yes, Ute Deichmann tells the story of them too. Anyway, it was mostly the ones who came here as teenagers or something like that, or at the beginning of their careers, who then contributed. Beginnings of their careers who contributed to American science. What did it mean? Overall, the Nobel Prize is an absolute plus to only two people or institutions, your parents and your university, for different reasons. Parents get some of that naches that I mentioned. Your university uses you shamelessly in advertising. It's okay. It's okay. Cornell has done something for me, they can use that. For everyone else, it's not necessarily a plus. For me, so let's go through some of the pluses, some of the minuses. I can get more money for a certain kind of lecture as an honorarium than I can. I can, if I want to, advance into administration. Though actually my lectures, which are in much demand, well, some scientific lectures I could probably get paid more for them. But my lectures are in demand because of the science and art angle more than they are for that. And some of them carry no, I will do some of those with no payment, no fee or no honorarium. I forget now if I'm getting something from Penn next week or not. But I'm doing then the next week a lecture in honor of Alfred Bader at Queen's University in Canada. I'm not getting anything for that. I'm just doing that. But it's an art and science lecture. Anyway, I could, if I wanted to, have a path, and it was offered up to me, into administration, especially educational administration. So I was asked to apply for the presidencies of several universities, MIT most prominently. It's not a path I chose, but I could go in that direction. Maybe I should have established an institute somehow. Europeans and Japanese do that. Some Americans have done it here also. You can, but I, in general, it has not, okay, the press offers you infinitely more opportunities to make a fool of yourself. That's the best way to say it. An example was Shockley and his views on race. Of course the press is going to ask him, Dr. Shockley, what, once they get an inkling that he has some crazy idea about that. The press is the press, it will not change. The press is looking for criticism for negative views of anything in the, under the sun, for strong views. Will I get better students, more students? I don't need them. I don't think I got any better. Maybe some postdocs came with their own money. I think so. Most of those German postdocs came with their own money, thanks to the DAAD or Stiftung des Deutschen Volkes, Volkswagen thing. Or I have never been in a Humboldt Foundation, so I don't get any that way, but I'm very close incidentally to the Humboldt Foundation, but I've never been one of their members. Many of the Germans came with their own money. So did French and Japanese. That was a great contribution to my research. Some distance is generated between me and students, undergraduates, as a result. This is, fortunately, easily overcome either by me or by the students if they're Americans. But in China or Japan or India, I've never had such quiet audiences, attentive audiences, and it's because of that. It's the modern little thing off that is incredible pressure to take selfies with me or And in the beginning I used to fight it, but one time it got out of hand two places, once in South America, once in India. There was such a crowd, I was talking to an audience of undergraduates, which I like to do, and then there was such a crowd wanting to take pictures that it was dangerous. It pressed me against the balcony railing. I thought I was going to fall over. There was no crowd control. There is. And those things were obviously not to send to their teacher, but to put on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So this is modern mass culture integrating with some presumed mystique of the Nobel Prize. You're asked to sign lots of petitions. These have a, you have a chance to do some good, but in a number of those, you get a feeling that they really don't care whether I support nuclear disarmament. They just care that they have my name on a petition. But they don't really care what I think. It induces an alienation of the individual from, it separates you or someone. Research grants and papers are a real problem because, and I've written a little about that, where does the id come out? It comes out in the dark when you think you can't be seen. That's the refereeing process on papers and the grant process. If there are going to be some jealousies or envy, that's where it's going to surface, and I can tell you it does. I get these comments like, I do something not right, let's say, or, and I get a comment like, one would not expect a Nobel laureate to do this. Now, why are they saying that? It's just they want to get in a needle there. On papers, it's okay, and the editors know this. And I can keep my credentials for being a good referee. But on, from my side, but on proposals, it's deadly. Because these days, to get support, you need all excellent reviews. Just goods will not do. So I have seen really nasty things said about my papers by reviewers, and I think they're driven by this. So that's a minus. People think it's a plus. The Europeans can't understand how my research papers get rejected, but we had a paper last year, a good paper that was rejected from Angewandte Chemie, but I got it into JACS. A second paper was rejected from three journals, and we eventually got it into New Journal of Chemistry. Anyway, there's no guarantee. This is different from Woodward. Now, the difference is that Woodward did not publish much like I do. In his lifetime, you can see in that book, there are 125 papers. So when Woodward sent in 5 communications in 1 year, those communications were accepted without review. Mm-hmm. And the editor said so. But that's the luxury you buy when you get yourself in a position to not publish. He published too little. There is people knew there was great work in the theses that should have been published of his students. That was, he had the self-control or the desire, and he took infinite pains in writing his papers in a certain high style. Anyway, overall, it's been a mix. The most difficult thing is the following, and that comes with getting it young. So it's probably best to collect all the prizes in the world with a lot of money, with some of them. All the prizes that aspire to be some competition to the Nobel Prizes, like the Welch Award, the Wolf Prize, some prizes in Japan Prize. It's probably best to collect all that money and then get the Nobel Prize at 65. But it wasn't that way for me. So then, I joke about it, but first the thing that happened is, up to then, you heard me talk about that I've had the luxury to work on the next molecule down the line, just because I thought it was interesting. Well, that's the way I worked from the beginning. But then a natural question, not only for journalists, but also for even other people to ask you after you get the Nobel Prize, is the question, what will you do next? So Toni Morrison's or Norman Mailer's next novel is looked at in a different light because of the Nobel Prize. Somehow, and it's wrong, you expect more. But it cannot be that way. It cannot be that way. There's no reason. Even if you know rationally, it cannot be that way. So people would ask me, well, what are you going to do next? And they weren't asking, what are you going to do with the Nobel money? Which wasn't that much in those days. It was a low period of $90,000, which was then equivalent to 2 year salary, what I had at that time. That's what it was. And you know, if you are going along not thinking about what you're going to do next, but letting the molecules and the circumstances guide you in the way that I've just explained around that pentacene story. You begin to ask yourself, what am I going to do next? And I did that, and it bothered me for a while. When it came, I was in the middle of my inorganic period, and I should have gotten into the solid state extended structures earlier, but you can't do everything. I didn't. I let that come. Somehow I worked my way through that, and I feel good about what I've done, that I've kept that freedom to do the next thing without succumbing too strongly to that question. But it bothered me for a while, that question of what are you going to do next. And as for it was very nice after the Nobel Prize to get an ACS award in inorganic chemistry and then one in chemical education, because those represented somehow. So after the Nobel Prize, in general, you don't get awards. It's okay. It's part of its mystique. What you get is honorary degrees, so you stop accepting them after a while because you realize that they're serving the people more than yourself. Well, so some things are overall, it's a mixture of things, pluses and minuses. It's wonderful in some ways. But I have, sometimes I was thinking about the negative things that I just told you, I would say it's good I've survived that. What I mean by that is that I'm still able to do good science, publish 50 years in JCAM Phys after I first published a letter, still be excited about the nitroxyl radicals, that I have been able to do science, good science, and keep an enthusiasm for the chemistry, meanwhile doing these other things too. For it is now 33 years since that Nobel Prize. That's a long time.
Was this excitement about molecules that you resisted to move into management of science? You mentioned the MIT presidency and things like that.
Yes, I have a natural impatience with wasting time with people who are not interesting. On the other hand, I have a native belief that everyone's interesting if you could only probe through to some passion or interest of theirs. But part of the job, it was clear to me, of being a university president was you have to go to interminable dinners with people who are going to give you money.
You bet.
Like you. And some of them are interesting. And I now know how to get out those passions. I've learned how to get them out of people. I mean, positively, how to get them to talk about what's really interesting them. But the thought of being a university president and doing that all the time was just too much. I knew you could do good things, but it was not what I wanted to do. Let's take a break. Oops, we're almost done. We will have to be done.
Yes.